Al will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, Al.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our sponsors, Old School Labs and Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding and we talk about the history of bodybuilding. And I am your host, John Hansen. And today on the show, we have an interview with a former IFBB judge. His name is John Colacione. And John is from the East Coast. He's from New York. In addition to being a judge, John has been in the bodybuilding world for a long time. So I just recently heard him being interviewed by John Torelli on John's new Facebook page, Classic Bodybuilding. And I think John Torelli has a website also for that. But when I heard the interview with John, I remembered his name because when he used to judge shows back in the 1980s, and I got a sense that he really has a sense of bodybuilding history because he's been around for a long time. And it turns out John was able to see the very first Mr. Olympia in 1965 in New York, and he also saw it in 1966. And he also saw Sergio Oliva win all three of his Mr. Olympia contests from 67 through 69. And then he also saw 1970 when Arnold beat Sergio. And then when the Olympia came back to New York after it was gone for a couple of years in Europe, John saw Arnold win in 1973 and 1974. And then, as I said, he was one of the top judges in the IFBB for many years during the 1980s. He saw Lee Haney win all of his contests. And I believe he judged all the way up until the early 2000s. So John has seen a lot, and we talk a lot about bodybuilding, especially about the history of bodybuilding and his memories of some of those great Mr. Olympia contests. And we also talk a little bit about Pumping Iron 2, because John was one of the judges at that contest. And I'm getting ready to record a new season for the Bodybuilding Legends podcast about the women bodybuilders. So it was very interesting to hear John's thoughts on that. And I want to mention right off the top that we are brought to you by our sponsor, Old School Labs. I have been with Old School Labs for several years now. This is the supplement company that draws on the wisdom of the golden era of fitness and bodybuilding to offer unique supplements for the discerning athlete. Old School Labs is the only brand that I use, trust, and associate my name with, and it is the brand I used to win the Natural Mr. Universe in 2012. You may have heard of their award-winning fat burner, Vintage Burn, which is the world's first muscle-preserving fat burner, or Vintage Blast, which is their two-stage pre-workout, or Vintage Brawn, which is the triple protein isolate powerhouse. It's packed with eggs, milk, and beef protein. Their products have no proprietary blends, no artificial flavors, colors, or sweeteners. Old School Labs is also the home of 1983 Mr. Olympia Samir Banute and bodybuilding legend Tom Platz. So use the discount code LEGENDS12 and you will get 12% off your order when you go to oldschoollabs.com. Old School Labs, supplements that make sense. All right, and what else is going on? Happy Memorial Day to everybody. We are recording this on Sunday, so tomorrow is Memorial Day. It is now the end of May, and the summer is officially here. So I hope you guys are in shape and ready for the pool and ready for the beach. But if you need help with your diet or your training, you can always contact me at naturalolympia@gmail.com. That's what I do. I design training and diet programs for people that want to transform their physiques. And I have a website called dadbod2ripbod.com. And you could just go on there. And if you didn't want to email me, just go directly to the website and you could fill out a questionnaire. And then at the end of the questionnaire, you just decide if you want the training part or the nutrition or both. And I will design a training and nutrition program for you to help you, guide you, and get you in shape. And I stick with you for the first 4 weeks of the program, and then we have follow-up programs after that. So if you're interested in that, just go to dadbodtoripbod.com. In other news, I do have a couple interviews coming up. One I'm excited about is John Araneta. John is one of the top bodybuilders from the 1980s, and we just interviewed recently Lee Labrada and also John Natashak. And John, unfortunately, took second to both of these great champions at the Nationals before they went on to win the universe and turn pro. John, unfortunately, never turned pro, even though he had one of the best physiques of the 1980s. He was always a top contender. I believe he won his class at the USA the year Mike Quinn won in 1987. And John was a middleweight. and he was a Rory Liedemeyer protege, and he had a physique very similar to Rory Liedemeyer, very symmetrical, very thick, always ripped, always in great shape, really great shape and symmetry on his physique. So looking forward to talking to him, and thanks to Lonnie Tieper for helping me set that one up. I also talked to Skip Robinson, and if you guys remember the 1970s bodybuilder Skip Robinson, he had a really good physique, blonde hair, sort of looked like a California guy. I think he's from the East Coast, though, actually. So I saw him on Facebook, and I contacted him, and he said he'd be open for doing an interview. And I'm supposed to interview Ruth Silverman also about our upcoming women's bodybuilder season. And Ruth is just going to give her thoughts on women's bodybuilding, because she covered women's bodybuilding for Flex magazine for many years. And then she went over to Ironman magazine when John Balik bought it. So Ruth has a vast knowledge of the whole women's bodybuilding scene. All right. What's your weather like out there? It is hot out here in Tampa. It was almost 100 degrees already. It's not even June yet. So I've been out here, I think, 9 years. I can't remember getting this hot this quickly, but this weather is just crazy all over the country. So I hope you guys are doing good with your weather, wherever you're at, if you're in America or around the world. I'm still reading that Mr. America book that was written by John D. Fair. And I got to the point in the book where they talked about Ken Sprague. And he was a promoter, of course. He promoted the Mr. America contest in 1977 and 1978. But he also owned Gold's Gym in the 1970s during the pivotal period, during the golden age of bodybuilding. And Ken really, really did a lot to promote the sport of bodybuilding. I really realized that when I read this book. Not that I didn't realize it before. When we did our interview with him recently, he talked a lot about that. But this book really goes into detail about all Ken did. And you wonder how much more he would have done if he would have stayed in the sport. But right after 1978, when his wife Marianne died, Ken got out of it. He was kind of burned out from promoting bodybuilding and running this gym and all the stuff he was doing. So you always wonder where the sport would have been if Ken Sprague would have stayed in it, because he was doing an incredible job promoting it. I also saw this great documentary about Muhammad Ali. It was on the HBO channel, if you have HBO. It was a two-part documentary called Remember My Name, and it was directed by Antoine Fuqua, who also was a movie director. And they had a lot of great clips in there of Ali, of course, from his fights. They had a lot of great clips in there of Ali from his fights, of course, but they also had a lot of great clips of him doing interviews. And actually, the film is kind of narrated by him, because they don't have an expert on there, or they don't talk to people that knew about Ali. They just use Ali's voice in all the interviews he did to kind of narrate his whole story. So I thought that was really a cool way to do it. And wow, it was really great seeing a young Ali again. That guy really was the greatest, not only as a boxer, but just the way he promoted the sport and just his personality. And he was really a real insightful and honest guy. A lot of the interviews, it was really great how he was very honest with himself. You know, when he got knocked out, he admitted he just didn't do his homework, or, you know, he could have did a better job. So I guess in this age of social media, where everybody tries to paint everything as being so perfect, it was great to see someone as realistic and honest and open as Ali was. But what a great, great champion, and he'll be remembered forever, that's for sure. So if you get a chance, check that out. It's called Remember My Name, and it's on HBO. And my training, I just wrapped up week 6 of my power cycle. It was kind of interrupted a few weeks ago because I got sick. So I'm glad that that's over. If you know about my training, I do that MP6 workout. I have a book called MP6 Workout. And I alternate power cycles that are last 6 weeks with mass cycles. So the power cycle is always kind of tough because I'm pushing heavy weight, doing low reps, like 3 to 5 reps, or maybe 5 to 7 reps if it's more of an isolation or shaping movement. And by the 6th week, I'm really ready to take a break because, you know, pushing that heavy weight for that long, for that many weeks, you start to get a little bit burned out. 6 weeks is about the max I can go. So next week, or this coming week, I'll just do what I call a deload week, where I use only 50% of my normal weight. So it's very, very light, just going through the gym, going through the motions, give my body a break, give my mind a break. And then next week, I'll start the mass cycle, which I'm really looking forward to. So then I use the weights that I built up to on the power cycle, and I use it for the mass cycle. So looking forward to that. Got to get my diet going still. I'm still eating too many of those damn cookies. I feel good. I feel big, but I got a little bit too much body fat. And I did get some good emails from our Annabelle Lopez interview. A lot of people liked that, so that was good to hear. When I put it up on Facebook, I got a lot of responses. Let me read the ones on Facebook first, and then I'll read the emails. Matthew Owen said, a physique to motivate, no drugs, great genes, and very hard work. Artie Lamparella, who is a frequent listener, says, another winner, John. That interview brought back so many memories. John, you and Annabelle did a fantastic job. Every one of your interviews are such an awesome inspiration. Al Acevedo said, I love this show. Billy Thomas said, wow, at 155 pounds, how tall was he? And Natty, too. Shane Gilbertson, who is an NPC competitor out here in Florida, and I believe Shane is also another natural competitor. I remember when I had that Florida physique show, he won a couple overalls as a lightweight. He was a really good bodybuilder. Shane said, wow, this is super spectacular. I tried to find out how tall he was, but I can't find anything online. He must have dieted down to 155. And I responded to Shane. I told him, I think Annabelle is about 5'6", maybe 5'7". Richard Baldwin, who is a good friend of Annabelle, said, I consider Annabelle a friend, and he's one of the nicest guys I know, as I think you can tell from this interview. And then Annabelle responded, and he said, hey, guys, thank you for your kind words. John Torelli said, Annabelle Lopez, you have inspired me since the early 70s. It was great to hear you speak with John Hansen. And Al Acevedo said again, it was an honor to have met you, Annabelle, on stage at the 2018 OCB Southern Cross. Thank you for being a gentleman and an inspiration for natural bodybuilders. Pete Venture from out here in Florida said it was a really great interview with one of the greats of our time. And Joe Means said, I was inspired by Annabelle showing at the 1973 Mr. America where he placed third, but he could have easily won. Annabelle showed that you didn't have to be a mass monster to place or win in national competitions with the right blend of size, definition, and proportion. And Annabelle is doing a fundraiser that he has on GoFundMe. So if you're on Annabelle's Facebook page, check that out. He's promoting something on GoFundMe, so you can check that out. And I also got some emails, so I want to read those because I always appreciate you guys taking the time to email me. If you have any comments on the shows or suggestions, just email me at naturalolympia@gmail.com. All right, this one is from Frank Jones, and Frank says, hi, John. First of all, I'd like to say that I love your podcast. I have followed bodybuilding since the early 80s, and it is great to learn more about the legends that I admire and about those that I never knew about. I have never competed, but your podcast bit me with the iron bug once again. I can tell from your podcast that you're a reader, so I would like to suggest a book. I'm not sure if you've read it or not, but if you have not read it, check out Chemical Pink. It's a great book and would make an interesting movie if they get the right actors and actress. Speaking of movies, I would also like to suggest the movie Teddy Bear and the short film which inspired the movie. The short film is titled Dennis, and I guess it is on YouTube. He has a link there for the YouTube. So he said, take care and keep up the great work with all you do. Frank Jones. Thank you, Frank. I heard of that book, Chemical Pink. I'm not sure what it's about, but I do remember hearing about that, so I'll check that out. Thank you for that suggestion. And then my friend Bill Nealon from Florida said, great interview with Annabelle, John. He and I are friends, and I've been to his home a few times. He put me through one of his high-intensity workouts several years ago. He's a great guy. And Bill is a judge out here in the Florida area, and he's training a girl named Susan Price, who has made an amazing transformation. She is a pro bikini competitor, I believe, or figure. I'm not really sure which one. But I always follow her on Facebook. She has an amazing physique. And when you've seen pictures of her from a couple of years ago, she was really fat and out of shape. So what a transformation. She has the kind of body, it looks like she's been lean her whole life. So congratulations to Bill for training her and doing a great job. Pat Comer, one of our great listeners of the show, a good supporter, always sends me articles. He said, great show with Annabelle Lopez. It's great to see the golden age bodybuilders who are in great shape and still training in the late stages of life. I've been a fan since I read Annabelle Lopez, A Study in Physical Perfection, in the January 1976 issue of Iron Man. Let me know if you want me to send you a copy. And then Pat scanned that article for the email. But yeah, maybe I'll have Pat send that to me and I can read it one of these weeks on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, because I can't really read it. It's a little too small. And then I got another email from Mark, and he says, hi, John, I just finished listening to your interview with Annabelle Lopez, and I have to tell you, it was one of my favorites by far. His positivity toward life and bodybuilding is truly inspiring. Is there a possibility of having a part two or even a part three with him? I would love to hear more from Annabelle regarding his training, diet, contest prep as a pioneering natural bodybuilder during the golden era, and of course, more great untold stories from his life. His recounting of the conversation he had with Bill Pearl was one of the most heartfelt and beautiful moments out of any episode thus far. I'm proud to tell you that I've now listened to every episode of Bodybuilding Legends Show podcast, and I can confidently say that I have earned at least a bachelor's degree in bodybuilding history. Thank you, Professor Hansen. Your reputation as a world-class bodybuilder and historian allows you to get the most out of each interview, all while keeping up an enjoyable, relaxed atmosphere. While I was familiar with many of the greats from the 60s and 70s, I had little knowledge of all the amazing physiques that were prominent in the 80s. Your show, in combination with the ability to watch videos such as the NPC Nationals and the IFBB Mr. Universe on YouTube from this decade, has greatly deepened my appreciation for the sport. I'm definitely looking forward to your upcoming series on the incredible women of bodybuilding. All right. Thank you, Mark. That was very nice. So thank you to all the people who took the time out to email me. I appreciate that. Like I said, if you guys want to email me about anything, any questions, concerns, thoughts on the show, whatever, please feel free to email me at naturalolympia@gmail.com. And I want to thank the guys over at Bodybuilding Nerds Radio, VJ Puri and Scott McNally, for also reviewing the show last week. They both really liked the interview with Annabelle Lopez. They also liked the article that I read about Frank Zane and his three dreams that predicted his Mr. Olympia wins, which I thought was a really fascinating article also. And speaking of articles, I am going to read another article right at the conclusion of our interview with John Colacioni. And this one is called The Psychology of a Mr. Olympia Competitor, written by Mike Mentzer. And this was written right after the 1979 Mr. Olympia, which was probably Mike's greatest shape ever, where he took a very close second place to Frank Zane. He was actually leading after the prejudging, going into the pose down, going into the night show. But Frank defeated him in the pose down. So it's a really good article about Mike Mentzer. And it was all about his preparation for that 1979 Mr. Olympia contest, the ups and downs he experienced. And it actually comes from the same issue that the Frank Zane article about dreams came from, the March 1980 issue of Muscle and Fitness. So I will read that as soon as our interview with John is over with. All right, and before we get to our interview with John, I do want to mention also that we are brought to you by our other sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. If you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn fat, and balance your hormone levels to maximize your potential, then go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. They have a certified and knowledgeable staff that will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results that you've been looking for. They offer a wide range of services that ensure you will not only look and feel amazing, but also be comfortable knowing that they're there for you every step of the way. They have competitive pricing along with their quality products and services, so those are just a few reasons to give them a call. So call them at their office number out here in Tampa, Florida, which is 813-922-8939. Or you can reach them at their website, which is flalternativemeds.com, and mention that you heard the ad on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, and they will give you a free consultation. Plus, they will give you 20% off your order. And they also have a new product called the Magic Pill. It's developed and backed by science. It's a formula that was made by chemists and expert formulators who are working with Florida Alternative Medicine. It's a revolutionary fat-burning product, and it's getting rave reviews from athletes all over the country. So if you want to order a month's supply of this amazing fat loss pill and thermogenic, it is $39.99. You can call Florida Alternative Medicine at 813-922-8939 to order your own supply. All right, so that is it for our opening. And here's our interview with former IFBB judge John Colacioni, where we talk about the old days of bodybuilding. Hope you enjoy it. Here we go. All right. Welcome back to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. And my guest today is John Colacioni. John was a judge with the IFBB for many years and has been around the sport for a long time. And John, I saw your interview last week with John Torelli on his new show. So you had a lot of old stories, and we're all about the old days of bodybuilding, the golden era. So I thought you'd be great to have as a guest on the show.
Well, if you're talking about old guys and old days, that's me. I mean, if you want to talk about old days, I was at the first Mr. Olympia contest back in 1965. That was an experience. I was 19 years old, and
wow. We
were all waiting for Larry Scott to step on stage. And I remember the MC was Bud Parker, who was actually the promoter of the show also, but nobody knew that at the time. And okay. He didn't even get the word Larry out of his mouth because everyone knew that he was going to come out. And when I tell you, I have never heard such thunderous applause and such a vociferous reaction from mm-hmm. an audience that I did that night, where the old Brooklyn Academy of Music floor actually shook.
Wow.
It was vibrating. It was a crazy scene. And I saw Larry win it again in 66. And then I saw Sergio Oliva win in 67, 68, and 69. And there was a great little story I'd like to run by you if you have time.
Absolutely.
I was at the 66 Mr. Olympia. I was in the third row, right-hand section of the Brooklyn Academy of Music. So I felt someone sit down next to me, and I really didn't turn to see who it was. And I heard this guy in a kind of a high-pitched voice critiquing everybody that was on stage. They had the Mr. America, Miss Universe that night for the IFBB, and then the Mr. Olympia. And this guy was, I didn't even turn. And he was just critiquing no legs, no back, no this, no that. And I turned to my right, and I see this behemoth of a human being with this beanie cap on, and it was Sergio Oliva. And he was a mountain of a man, you know.
Wow.
20 years old, I said, oh my God. What is this thing I'm sitting next to? And it was Sergio. And I'll tell you, for a young, impressive bodybuilder, that was quite an experience for me.
Right.
It was really fun. And then in 1969, Arnold actually competed against Sergio, and Sergio defeated him in 69. And in 1970, that was when Arnold began his reign. And I don't think Sergio was ever the same after that. Beat, except in 72, when he probably should have beat Arnold that day.
Yeah.
You know, I really believed he should have beat him. You know that Sergio never dieted.
Mm-hmm.
Never dieted. Ate whatever he wanted. And the one year that he did diet, he got into that magnificent condition. But
yeah.
But I've seen them all. I've seen them all and judged most of them. And I, you know what, John, I have to tell you, I always had the best seat in the house. I was really privileged, you know, to be there through all of those years. So if you have questions, if you want to know about anyone, please just fire away.
When did you start bodybuilding, John? Did you start like this when you were a kid?
I started bodybuilding in 1961. I was actually 15 years old. And how I got started was, I think I had related this to John Torelli, that in 1959, I went to see Hercules and then Hercules Unchained. Mm-hmm. And I saw Steve Reeves and I said, wow, this is the greatest thing I've ever seen. This guy pulling down columns with chains and having a physique like that. And I want to be like this guy. Unfortunately, he was 6'1". I was 5'6", and I could never emulate that.
Right. That movie has inspired so many people. I can't tell you how many people I've interviewed who are around your age, and they all point to that movie. That was like the biggest reason for most people getting into bodybuilding at that time.
That was it. There was no other reason. I mean, I had begun to exercise when I was like 12 years old because I was a fat kid.
Okay.
And I just began to do the calisthenic thing and the Charles Atlas courses and all of that stuff. And by the time I was 15, I said, nah, this is not going to work. Lifting weights. And I was in high school and I joined the weightlifting team where my real love was bodybuilding. But I was 147 pounds at that time. And I won the New York City weightlifting championships for high school.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Wow.
That was a fun time. But my pull was always toward bodybuilding. By 1963, I didn't want to weightlift anymore. I wanted to bodybuild.
What was the first real gym you went to, John?
The first real gym was my local YMCA. And it was probably built, I mean, the weight room was probably built in the 1920s and 1930s.
Wow.
And we had no pads on the benches. They were plain, flat wooden benches. We didn't have squat racks. We didn't have anything like, no, I'm sorry, we did have squat racks. We had inverted, and we had one inverted leg press. And if you had to do bench presses, you had to have a guy on each side of you lift the barbell into position. And you had to put a towel down on the bench, because otherwise you'd come up with these black and blue marks right down, you know, like the two sides of your back.
And
that was archaic training. But you know what? It doesn't matter where you train. You can train anywhere. Mm-hmm. Barbells and dumbbells are really the foundation of bodybuilding. They have great machines today. They have great apparatus today. But the foundation has always been barbells and dumbbells, for me anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, one thing you said to John, which I really agreed with 100%, was you thought that barbell rows was one of the best exercises.
Oh.
And I've been preaching the value of barbell rows for decades. You know, I think that's one of the best things to do for building your back. One of the best basic exercises ever.
Yeah, and it's absolutely the upper body squat. You know what it is?
Yeah, yeah.
That is the upper body squat. And that's been said before, but it really is. It builds mountains of muscle. And I think some of the newer physiques, I think they kind of stay away from it because it is a hard exercise. But you can work on up to some prodigious poundages.
Mm-hmm.
You're strong. I mean, it builds all kinds of strength. But I agree with you on that. And look at your body. You are a testament to good bodybuilding training, I'm sure.
Oh, thank you. Well, and like you said too, John, most guys do it wrong today. Like, people just don't do it right. They don't bend over the bar, you know, like you're supposed to.
They do it at a 45-degree angle or even a 30-degree angle, which is horrible.
Right.
And it doesn't get the meat of the back, you know?
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
You're a proponent of that as well as I am.
I just saw a news clip on Facebook of Dale Ruplinger. Remember him?
Sure.
And he was filming, they did it for some local TV station. It must have been in Iowa where he lived. And it probably was after he won a contest, and he was doing bent over rows, standing on that block. That's the way we used to do them, where you get that big stretch on the bottom and then just pull it up, you know? Yeah.
Yep.
Nobody does them like that anymore.
No, they're afraid.
Yeah.
They're afraid. They don't have our kind of guts. Things change.
Yeah,
things
for sure.
Change, and the bodies have certainly changed as the years have gone by. And I was always an aficionado of the 60s, 70s, and 80s were kind of classic-looking physiques.
Yeah.
And by the mid-90s, I thought it was all over.
Yeah, I agree. That's what this show is all about, celebrating the 60s, 70s, and 80s.
I know that. I mean, I had a few favorites, you know, as everybody else did. I was a judge at so many amateur and real professional competitions that I didn't want to go to Columbus, Ohio anymore to judge the Arnold Classic. Would you believe that? I didn't want to go there anymore. And I got sick of Las Vegas. I didn't want to go to Las Vegas anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's something that I did and something that I enjoyed. And as the years went on, things had changed, bodies changed, and they weren't to my liking anymore. I saw things happening by 2003, 2004 that really kind of soured me on what was happening in our activity at the time. And by 2005, I said, I'm not going to compromise my integrity and sit at this table anymore. And I left. It was very, I don't know, it was kind of a letdown, but I was glad that I walked away at the time. And I never thought that I would be involved in it again until Wayne D'Amelio and Jim Rockell and myself were contacted by the International Federation of the real International Federation of Bodybuilders from Spain. And they asked us to establish the amateur leg here in the United States, because at that point they had severed all of their ties with the NPC. And they were no longer the affiliate in America for the International Federation. So we said, after so many years, I says, you know what? I'm in. I'll do this. But only if we can bring sensible bodybuilding and sensible competition back to the States again. Otherwise, I wouldn't have got involved. I'm not doing it for the money, John, I assure you.
Right.
I'm doing it because I'm half nuts with this stuff. And I still am after so many years. It's, you know, I mean, look, when you grow up with this, it becomes so ingrained in you that without it, you know, you say, well, now what am I going to do? <You know? laughs> now what do I do? And I mean, I'm doing things now on the administrative level that I never dreamed about during my real judging years. And I'm still doing a lot of head judging.
With oh, yeah?
Now. Yeah. I enjoy it. And once again, I have the best seat in the house. So I can't, I really can't complain about it.
Now, when you say sensible physiques, John, I mean, going back to the 1960s and you were looking at the guys back then, we just did a few shows about this subject where we were talking about how symmetry was so valued back then, you know, back in the older days, compared to just mass and conditioning.
Oh, please. You know what? I don't call this bodybuilding anymore. It's monster building. The aesthetics have been completely cast aside. The notion of symmetry is a fantasy. Muscular size and muscular development has become prevalent and overshadows everything else. I think that Frank Zane had the ideal kind of classic physique that people would want to aspire to.
Right.
I mean, I saw Frank win all three of his Mr. Olympias, and I brought my father-in-law with me one time to Columbus, Ohio, and this man knew nothing about bodybuilding. I had not begun judging on the pro level at that time. I believe it was 1979. And he was more like a little brother to me, my father-in-law. And well, he was sitting next to me. We had great seats. And, of course, the lineup came out on stage. And you had Robbie Robinson and Boyer Coe and Dennis Tenorino. We had, we had such great bodybuilders back then, real aesthetic-looking guys, you know. And, and I told him, I said, Frankie, that was my father-in-law's name. I said, Frankie, pick me the winner up there. This guy knew nothing about bodybuilding. And he looked at that lineup and he said, you know, there's a lot of big guys up there, but that number one guy looks perfect. And that was Frank Zane. So right. He stood out. He wasn't a muscular marvel, but his proportion, his condition, his balance, the aesthetics of his physique. He didn't need to be 200 pounds. Frank at his best was probably 182 pounds.
Yeah.
You know? And another secret, that I'll let you in on, most of the guys that were telling you that they were 210 and 220 were under 200 pounds.
Right. It was exaggerated.
And that was most of them. That was most of them. Of course, I knew most of them.
Right.
But when they went on stage, they wanted to project that big, massive bodybuilder stuff. But we don't have those bodies anymore.
In the early 60s, John, when you were training and then eventually you got into competition, when you looked at the competitions and you looked at competitors, I mean, were all the competitors in the gym focusing on symmetry as well as size? You know, were they just going into the gym, I just want to get bigger? Or were they building their physiques I got to develop the symmetry also?
No, we certainly had a plan. We trained for balance development. We had it in our heads, and there was kind of a brotherhood, even in competition at that time. Nobody was cutthroat back then. We were all friendly. You know, we used to meet at the gym and have a good time and laugh, and we'd go out and have Chinese food afterwards. We didn't know that much about diet at the time. Whatever that we wanted, you know. And of course, at the time, the bulking up craze was pretty big during the 1960s. And, you know, so you tended to get a little heavier than you should have been. But we never trained to be gargantuan. Of course, look, we all wanted size. But genetically, most of us are not predisposed toward that kind of terrific development. Most of us have to work very, very hard for a good number of years, let's face it. But we train sensibly and basic. And of course, I did not have great genetics when I started, but I was determined to do something that my friends, you know, they didn't do. And I wanted to compete, and I did. And between 73 and 1977, when I stopped competing, because I had to feed my kids, of course, you know, there was no money at that time.
Right.
I put together probably 12 or 15 first place trophies, you know.
Okay.
They weren't major competitions. I mean, the best competition that I won in 77 was the Mr. Eastern America. And I had a health food business at the time, and it kind of helped my business. And, you know, I said, okay, I have to make a choice. Although I can go on with this and take drugs, or I can be sensible and raise my family and do what a man has to do in order to have a balanced life.
Yeah.
And I chose the latter. I had people that I had to take care of. So, and that was the time that I began to judge, in 1977, 1978.
Okay.
And that's when
I
got started.
Wow. Okay. Now, you mentioned the drugs. I, from what I understand, back in those days, not too many guys were even, I think they pretty much started getting more popular around the 60s, right?
Probably the mid-60s was the time that guys started to experiment, and we didn't have much to experiment with. Like, I got to tell you, there was not much around.
Right.
There was Dianabol.
Yeah, you know, that was the big one, yeah.
And then a little later on, there was Decadorabolin. You know, that came on later. But as far as us knowing how to stack anything, the only thing that we could stack are shoes in a closet. We just don't need stuff, right. You know. And I think that we stayed healthier because of it. I mean, the guys that really got into drugs paid the price.
Mm-hmm.
They paid the price. I think we've lost more guys in the last 10 years I won't even talk about. I mean,
right. Just
fallen by the wayside. And they were good bodybuilders.
Yeah.
Some of them were really aesthetic bodybuilders. But
one thing you just said too, you said it took years of work before you would even get up on stage, right? I mean, you would go to the gym and it would take, 3 to 5 years before you even thought about going to the show.
I trained for 10 years before I stepped on stage.
Wow, 10 years.
That's a long time. And I still train. I mean, I still train. I can't train as hard as I used to train.
Right.
Of course, I'm not too young anymore, but it's my therapy. It's been the best discipline of my life, and it keeps it focused and directed. And I think it's been a terrific thing, and I'm still enjoying the ride. I have to say, I'm still enjoying the ride.
Hey, John, I want to take you back to some of those earlier shows. Good. When you went to that 65 Olympia, the AAU America was probably still the big show around that time, right? But that was the first Olympia, so that was kind of the IFBB really stepping in, and that was their really first big show, correct?
Well, the IFBB was holding shows in the earlier 60s. I remember Frank Zane in 1963 or 65. Listen, I saw Frank when he was a very young guy.
Yeah.
I think he won the Mr. Eastern States or the Mr. Tri-State at the time. And then Frank went off from there and he moved to Florida and then he began to progress. He retired from teaching at a very young age.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right. The Mr. America was still the golden ring at that time. And the Mr. Olympia was kind of a lark that Joe had, Joe Weider, you know, and I don't know if you know the story behind how they came up with that name.
Yeah. Yeah. With the beer, the Olympia beer.
Yeah, and that's when it happened, you know. And he had actually convinced Larry Scott to compete, and he offered him $1,000 at that time, which was not a small amount of money when you were making $95 a week.
Right,
you
know, I mean, right.
$1,000 was a lot of money. Larry did compete, and he won, and no judge dared had him less than first place because he was the god at the time.
Yeah.
And Joe, instead of giving him $1,000, gave him a crown.
Right.
And Larry was livid.
Was he really?
He wanted that $1,000 because that's what he was promised.
The next year
he did get the $1,000.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
One of the forgotten guys, one of the guys that was overlooked in some of the very early Mr. Americas of the 1960s, I got to say, was Harold Poole. I don't know if you're familiar with Harold.
Sure, yeah.
Okay, Harold at 17 and 18 years old should have been Mr. America.
Wow, that's amazing. At that young of an age, that's incredible.
He should have beaten Vern Weaver in 1963.
Yeah, that's what I read. Yeah. I read that.
There was no doubt about it.
Man.
Harold was a phenom.
Yeah.
And, you know, and he might have beaten Larry Scott in 1966 had he not been just a little too heavy. Mm. And again, Larry was Larry was the icon of the 60s. There's no doubt about that.
What do you think it was about that that 65 contest where the people went so crazy? Because I've talked to a few people, and they all told me the same story you did. You know, the place just went insane. It was like the biggest ovation anyone could – you know, people have seen bodybuilding shows for 40 years. They said that was the biggest ovation they ever heard.
Yep. The only one that came close to it was Ed Corney in Columbus, 77. Ohio. That was amazing. But yeah. Larry Scott, okay, I want to go back to that.
Yeah.
You know, Joe was a master at knowing how to sell a product. Mm-hmm. Joe Weider knew how to sell a product. And the product at the time was Larry Scott. Larry was that handsome blonde guy from the West Coast, mm-hmm. you know, who captured the imagination through Joe's constant exposure in the magazines. And I want to talk about that afterwards. That constant exposure made Larry so popular. And at that time, he was training at Vince Gironda's gym. Mm-hmm. And that was like the Mecca there. You know, you had Don Howard there, and you had, oh my God, so many guys that were training out there. And that's what made Larry the icon. Joe's constant publicity in Muscle Builder and Mr. America magazine that gave the exposure to so many bodybuilders at that time, not just Larry. But Larry captured their imagination because he was a good look. And those arms and shoulders, whew, you had to see them in person.
Yeah.
He could blow you away with those things.
Yeah, and I interviewed Jerry Branham, and he made a good point because Jerry was from New York, too, and he saw that contest.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, you know Jerry? Yeah.
He was in Brooklyn yet when I had the health food store. In fact, he asked me about it when I spoke to him not too long ago.
You
know, so no, I know Jerry. Guy's got a lot of knowledge.
He's great to talk to. But he was saying back then, all the bodybuilders in the West Coast, nobody ever really saw him in person. So when they came to New York and they competed, that was the first time all the people from the East Coast got to see these guys in person. So it was like seeing a movie star in person, right?
Yep, absolutely. And the West Coast became the Mecca. So,
right.
I mean, it got so popular that Joe and Ben Weider moved their corporate offices from Union City, New Jersey, out to California in 1971, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when the really, you know, that West Coast aura became so entrenched. If you didn't train on the West Coast, you are not going to be a champion, which was a total fallacy.
Right.
You can train in a dump, you know.
Yeah.
But one thing that we've lost, we have lost the magazines.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm telling you, John, the magazines were the vehicle that really gave exposure to a lot of guys that would never have had their names known anywhere in the world.
Yeah.
And those publications really brought to the forefront these people that we know as the pioneers, you know, I mean, the golden era, the golden age, as you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the magazines. And as the magazines died, so did the stars.
Yeah.
John, we don't have stars anymore.
No, we don't. And I miss those magazines because we used to get good stories and, you know, good articles, real good writers in there. You know, it really gave you a sense of what was going on with the shows and the personalities and everything.
Yep. And I used to love the old Iron Man magazine, you know, with the yellow header.
And right, right.
I mean, they were great magazines. And I remember when Muscular Development came out in 1964. John Grimmick was the editor, I guess, under Bob Hoffman, and he was on the first cover.
Yeah.
You know? And that was another new magazine that was out in 1964, and those were the things that built the stars.
And when
Joe sold the magazines, the circulation went down because of the rise of the internet, of course.
Yeah.
But to me, there's nothing like holding that magazine in your hand and going through the glossy pages and looking at the pictures and reading the articles. I'm sure as you did.
Yeah. I remember being 14. I couldn't wait for that thing to come out every month, you know.
God, there was a newsstand not too far from the house. I used to run there every week to see if something was coming out.
Right. Read it from cover to cover in one night.
Absolutely. In fact, I used to, I guess I used to read the advertising in the magazine.
Right.
See if there was any secrets out there that I didn't know about. So,
I don't know if you ever heard my podcast before, John, but what I've been doing this year is at the end of each interview, I take an article from an old magazine and I read it, you know, because I'm sure a lot of our listeners never saw those magazines. So at least we get to share those magazines a little bit, you know, with our listeners.
I have an enormous collection of magazines.
Oh, but you still got them all?
I got them from the 1940s and 1950s, which was really before me. And I have some from the early 60s. I even have a few from the late 30s that I was given. I was given all of these magazines.
Oh, no kidding. Wow.
And, oh, my God. And every once in a while, I'll thumb through a couple of them and see what the bodies were like and the training methods. And they were quite archaic, yeah. But you know what? That's what they had, and it worked. And it was, listen, some of those guys were very strong.
Mm-hmm.
Some of these guys in the 40s, like I don't know if you know who Clarence Ross is.
Sure, yeah.
Okay, 1945 Mr. America.
And Marvin Utter, I heard he was a monster.
He was strong as an ox.
Yeah.
He used to do repetition presses with 300 pounds. He was a beast, and he had a great physique.
Yeah, yeah.
Clarence Ross had a great physique. The aesthetics were all there, you know. But as far as anything else, I mean, I think that the disintegration and deterioration of bodybuilding is horrible.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're trying to do, as I said before, we're trying to bring back that aesthetic, pleasing look that's achieved through good, hard training and sensible diet. And we're trying to reward our winners by sending them to international competitions, all expenses paid. Hmm. No other federation does that. Nobody does that. I don't care where you go. Nobody does that. All the other federations are out to just make the money and they go from there. They're looking for the entry fees and the sanction fees, and we don't even charge a sanction fee.
Oh, really?
IFBB Physique America does not charge a sanction fees. We want the promoters to be successful, and we want our competitors to feel valued and appreciated. And that's what we're doing.
Hmm.
I mean, if you want to ask me about anybody from that era, I probably know them. So
I wanted to go back to Sergio because you mentioned him. He was sitting next to you. So he competed the first time in the IFBB in '66, right? So you got to see him then too. He was like third, I think, or fourth when Larry won the second time, and I think they gave him the Mr. World that night too, right?
Yeah. Yes, you're right. And I think that Larry knew that the handwriting was in the wall because Sergio was kind of the first to usher in the first of the huge bodybuilders. I mean, he was like nothing that nobody had ever seen before.
Yeah. And how did he look in '66? I know he got much bigger later on, a couple of years later, but could you see the potential? Could you see what was coming?
Oh, God, he was huge.
Was he? I mean, okay.
He was enormous. But, you know, he lacked that detail that you would want to see.
Mm-hmm.
Sergio was not a careful diet guy. He got good in spite of his diet.
I mean, right.
You know, he didn't care about that.
All
and
right.
He was very nonchalant about things. And, you know, he used to train a very I never saw him do a full movement.
Yeah, that's what I heard. A lot of pumping movements, right? Like a lot of short movements.
Full movements. Never. I said, this guy, I don't know. He was just a freak, you know. He was just one of those genetic freaks. But he always had that real tiny, tiny waist, huge upper body.
I know, yeah.
But I think some people might not agree with me. I might hear this from some people. But, you know, Sergio, I don't know if you got this opinion. He was good, I mean, really great a few times. But he had kind of, I don't know if I should use, blobby-looking muscles.
Uh-huh.
He didn't have that real defined look that you're looking for.
Right.
And I think that's why Larry probably beat him in '66, because Larry was spot on, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't have the greatest genetics, but he knew how to show exactly what he had.
Yeah.
And although Sergio was tremendous, he just couldn't beat him that year. But by 67, Sergio would have wiped him out because he did get better.
Yeah.
He did get absolutely.
So, how was it in 69 when he beat Arnold for the first time? What was it like seeing Arnold in the first? I think he was only 22 years old that year. How was that seeing him for the first time?
Arnold was good. Arnold was not. Listen, he was a baby.
Yeah.
You know, and Arnold was good. And you could see that he didn't have the maturity of the physique that Sergio had. He didn't win by much, Sergio.
Mm-hmm.
But he had enough of a package to beat Arnold that year. And it was the last time that he did.
Yeah.
I was there. I was also there in 1970.
Okay.
And Arnold beat Sergio. And I believe I'm pretty sure it was a town hall. My memory slips sometimes with some of the shows.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think they moved it from the Brooklyn Academy to the town hall, right?
Yeah. They moved to town hall. And the audience was so nuts. And the judges were in such disarray at that time.
Oh, yeah. You know,
that they actually brought Sergio and Arnold downstairs out of the sight of the public to do some comparisons.
Wow, really?
Yep. I knew the judges at the time.
Uh-huh.
And they came back upstairs, Arnold and Sergio, came back upstairs. They went to center stage to pose down. And, you know, they were carrying on and they were posing and the people were going nuts. and Arnold turned to Sergio and you could see that he told him something, okay? And it was that he told him that they should leave the stage together.
Yeah.
And Sergio left and left Arnold standing there alone. He was pretty sharp. Even as a young guy, he was pretty sharp. I got
right.
I have to tell you. And that's when Arnold began his reign.
Yeah.
And
now, who would you have picked, John, in that night in 70? Who do you think was better?
I think Arnold was just a touch better.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. Arnold had a quality about him that was almost undefinable. He had these qualities that, I mean, his muscles jumped when he posed. I mean, biceps, the back. And Sergio probably had him a little in size, but Arnold was just, he looked more finished. He was more finished than Sergio in 1970.
Yeah.
Not much, but enough to beat him.
Yeah.
Enough to beat him. And I think Sergio got very bitter after that, although he was a pretty good guy, Sergio, but I don't think he was ever happy again.
Right.
And then after 72, that was the last that he was around for quite a while, I think.
Yeah.
He did compete again. He did compete again. I believe it was 84.
84, yeah.
Mm-hmm. 84, and he finished eighth in that contest. I was there as a judge in that show. And, time goes on. Arnold had already retired and went in. And, of course, he went to motion pictures and stuff like that. But as time passes, so does the standard of bodybuilding.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, it deteriorated by the mid-90s, as we said before.
Yeah.
After
70, they moved the Olympia out of the country for a while. But were you there in 73? Mm-hmm. Did you get to see Arnold win it in 73 when it was back in New York?
Yes.
Wow. Yes, okay. What was that like?
Arnold got better and better, you know. And when you looked at Arnold, you know, you saw this transformation of a raw, young, big bodybuilder to this guy that was just refining every facet of his physique, where you knew he was unbeatable. You knew he was unbeatable. I mean, he would step on stage and there was nobody else. It was like, all right, so who's going to stand next to this guy now? And in 73, and in 74, that was the absolute best Arnold ever.
So you saw that one too, 74.
Arnold was at his absolute best ever.
Yeah.
He was so defined and so big and so balanced and had that small waist. He had such great proportion.
Mm-hmm.
To me, he was unbeatable at the time. And I wasn't a big Arnold fan at first. I have to tell you, I wasn't a big Arnold fan. I said, this guy's just too damn good. This guy's just too damn good,
John. Now, you got to see him, John, at his best, the 73, 74. So when you saw the guys later on in the late 70s, and then you saw the guys in the 80s, how would you compare Arnold to the later eras?
Well, if we're talking about
not like the 2000s. I know they got huge, but maybe the 80s. You know,
I'm
80s
talking about. If you're talking about the 80s, you're talking about Lee Haney.
Yeah.
I mean, the guy won more Mr. O's in a row than anybody else.
And
you couldn't help but like Lee Haney.
Mm-hmm.
He was not only a great bodybuilder, but a really good person.
Yeah, yeah, what a great guy.
I was at his home in Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
And it was probably at the time when the Mr. Olympias were being held in Atlanta. And he had invited us a bunch. He had invited a bunch of us to his home. And this was after he stopped like his last Mr. O. Mm-hmm. And we went to his house and he was so gracious and such a good guy. A very spiritual guy. He was a nice man.
Mm-hmm.
He was a nice man. I really can't say anything negative about Lee.
Mm-hmm.
Just a great guy, and a worthy champion, I have to say. How would Arnold compare?
Yeah.
It's so difficult to say because the standard did change.
Mm-hmm.
Haney was good, I got to say. He was a good Mr. Olympia. Arnold and him standing next to each other, I'll tell you the truth, I couldn't make a decision because you have to see that in person.
Yeah, yeah.
If you look at photographs and magazines, you just couldn't. But Lee Haney kicked everybody's butt in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
As good as everybody else might have been, Haney was the guy. I'll tell you who was a great one-time Mr. Olympia. He probably should have won twice with Samir Banu.
Yeah.
Samir probably should have won in 82.
Yeah, I agree.
I have nothing against Chris Dickerson. He knew how to present himself. But I just thought that Samir was better.
Yeah, I do too. Yeah.
He had one of the best backs of all time.
Yeah,
Samir's
amazing.
Back
was
outrageous. He lacked nothing back. And he was a worthy winner.
He was
a worthy winner. And he should have won it in 82. That's how I felt anyway.
When did you start judging, John?
I started judging on the amateur level. I started to judge around 1978.
Okay.
By 1982, I had graduated to the pro levels.
Hmm.
And I had... And from 82 to 2005, I had judged every championship, Mr. Olympia, Body Arnolds, whatever there was out there, I was sitting at the table.
Yeah.
that was great. So I saw a lot of really, really good guys.
Yeah, over
and
20
I
years.
Saw a lot of really, and I saw a lot of really good women, too.
Uh-huh.
We tend to forget that, that whole other side, which has become disgusting today. I'm sorry,
mm-hmm.
that's what
mm-hmm.
it's been, and we're bringing that back in a beautiful way too. You look from Rachel right on through Corey Iverson, they were great.
Yeah,
they were so pleasing to look at, John.
Yeah, so beautiful, and the posing routines were so good.
They had great aesthetics. Linda Murray was probably the first of the real more muscular type, aside from Bev Francis,
mm-hmm.
was kind of an anomaly at that time. We sold out the theater at Madison Square Garden a few times with the Miss Olympia alone.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? That's amazing.
5,000 people, John, with standing room. It was nuts for the Miss Olympia. You're in the 80s. By 1992, you couldn't sell 20 tickets.
Right. Why do you think that was, John? You're right. I mean, they don't really talk about that much anymore. But if you go back to when it started, why do you think there was so much acclaim for women's bodybuilding, especially from the media. You think it was just because it was the first time people saw women with muscles?
That, but you could sell it. You could sell that image. Mm-hmm. You can't sell the image of the bodybuilding women today, which is almost non-existent anymore.
Right.
You couldn't sell it. They were clamoring for it. They were beautiful, attractive, shapely, toned, muscled women who still looked gorgeous and presentable, and they conducted themselves with grace and balance.
Yeah.
It was a good thing.
Right.
And then it all fell apart.
Yeah.
And I'm going to tell you, it was as much the fault of the judges as it was the organizations that promoted it, because we allowed it to happen. We mm-hmm. did not mark down those looks. And it's a shame, until we said, are we all nuts? Are we all nuts here? You know, and I walked away from it, and I didn't want to have any other part of it ever.
But were you part of the judging panel for that Pumping Iron 2 when they made that?
I was there. That was
Were you? Thing. Really? I just watched that movie again. Yeah,
that was at Caesar's Palace. You'll see me there. At the time, I think I had a mustache. I think I had a mustache at the time, and I was a little younger. I was there. That was at Caesar's Palace. That was a fun thing to do.
Yeah.
And it was kind of a publicity thing, you know, too.
Yeah.
But it was a competition, and I believe Carla Dunlap won that.
Yeah.
And she was always a very gracious lady. Smile, always conducted herself with class.
Yeah, she was.
And, I always liked Carla. And I remember sitting at the judges' table, and Carla's mother was sitting to the side of the stage. And you didn't dare look her in the eye. And you didn't dare not put Carla in first place there, because that woman would kick the hell out of you. She was giving all the judges the evil eye, but she was the winner anyway. You know, there was no shenanigans there.
Yeah.
And
now was that true? Like what they portrayed in the movie? Was there like a discussion of, you know, how muscular do we let these women get, or do we let them just, you know, is that progress when they just get more muscular? That was the one Bev was in, and that was the first show she was in, right? And then that was a big controversy. Yeah.
In fact, the first time I met Bev was during the time right before we went to Vegas. She was actually staying at Wayne D'Amelia's home out on Long Island. Mm-hmm. And I had to go see Wayne for something, and Bev was there. And I mean, I had seen some muscular women before, but when she came out in her suit, I said, what the hell am I looking at?
Mm-hmm.
What is this? You know, but I knew that it was a product, and I'm talking about it like it's goods, you know, I'm sorry, but I knew that product would have very limited appeal to the general masses.
Mm-hmm.
I knew it would have very limited appeal. And I'm trying to think what place she finished. Was it eighth or sixth?
I think it was eighth, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think it was eighth, if my memory serves me, you know. And she did continue to compete. And I remember being in Los Angeles in, was it 91, 92? I don't remember anymore, Steve. 90, when Linda Murray was there. And I remember Bev was probably 1 point ahead after the prejudging, because the judges had allowed that muscularity thing to kind of jump to the forefront of their evaluation. And then at nighttime, it began to change. Linda was sharper. I thought she had a nicer body, no doubt about that. And Linda won by a point, 1 point at night. And I knew it was my vote that changed that whole thing and had a
Oh, really?
Well, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Hmm. And her husband didn't talk to me for 2 years after that. Bev's husband didn't talk to me for 2 years after that.
Right.
Because, you know, and listen, I John, I was there to do my job. Mm-hmm. And I just thought that Linda Murray was a better representative of the type of body that Bev was really presenting at the time. Mm-hmm. My own, you know, I never worried about my judge's fee. I never worried about this. I always wanted to do the best I could and give the right kind of evaluation of what I was seeing up on that stage.
Yeah.
And that's how I still feel.
Now, if you go back to that show, that one that was in Vegas, the one that was covered in Pumping Iron 2,
yeah.
The judges obviously decided, hey, this is too muscular, so we're going to give her eighth place, and then we're going to put women like Carla Dunlap and Rachel McLish and some of the other girls who were not nearly as muscular ahead of her.
And we were not influenced, I have to tell you, we were not influenced by anyone. We had taken into our heads, you know what, this is not the kind of physique that will sell. This is not the kind of physique that we can put on covers of magazines. And you didn't see that on covers of magazines. Mm-hmm. There was some beautiful, aesthetic, shapely women on magazine covers, you know.
Right.
And that's why Bev finished down where she did. Listen, I have nothing against Bev.
It's just her physique.
Just her physique. And if I have to be honest, that's what I saw.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what most of the judges, most of the other judges saw also.
You wonder if how women's bodybuilding would have continued, you know, if the judges would have stuck to that.
Yeah, it got pretty out of hand. By the time that Kim Krzyzewski started winning the Miss Olympias, oh my God.
Yeah.
That was like, I says, what are we looking at anymore? What are we doing?
Yeah.
What are we, all nuts? Yeah, we were all nuts, you know.
Well, I always think about that, too, when I look at men's bodybuilding also, because if you go back to the shows in the 70s, like when Frank Zane was winning, and I know the guys weren't as big back then in 1977 as they were like in 2007. But if you look at you look in the 80s, like when Samir won, you had Frank Zane beating out someone like Bertel Fox. And then you had Muhammad McAway taking second. So you had these smaller guys who had the great symmetry, and the judges were rewarding that, you know, and it seemed like, as the guys got bigger and bigger, probably mostly because of the drugs, the different drugs that came in. And then the judges just said, oh, we can't give it to these smaller guys. We got to give it to the bigger guys. I wonder how bodybuilding would have changed if they would have sort of punished those guys for being too big, you know, if they lost their symmetry.
You know what? You really hit it on the head right there. You hit it. You are so on the money with that evaluation, is that we should have kept rewarding those balanced, terrifically conditioned, aesthetically pleasing physiques rather than go to the mass monsters that have dominated, and the bodies, John, and I think that you'd agree with me, the bodies have gotten ugly.
Yeah.
Nobody aspires to look like these people. I'm sorry.
Right.
Nobody aspires to that look. It's impossible, first of all. And they're dying. They're dying. And all the sponsors are falling off. Attendance is falling off. I mean, I know that they have some very large expos. They're down 200 booths at some of the events.
I don't envy the judges, you know, what they have to go through, because it's got to be hard when the physiques start to change and then you see someone reach a new level of development and you're like, wow, you know, how can I not reward this? You know, or how do I take someone who's smaller and may have great symmetry? Even like Lee Labrada, look how good he did all the way up until the 90s, you know?
Lee was great. We had a lot of good body. There were so many good body bowlers. It's hard to just say, okay, this one is the greatest or that one is the greatest. There were so many different levels of good at that time. I mean, look at Kevin Lavrone. He was another great one, you know?
Right.
Sean Ray, he was
awesome. Yeah,
you know, these guys were all good. These guys were all great physiques. They were balanced, symmetrical. They had the small waist, the beautiful detail. Now I see these guys that are competing for these big titles. I'm saying, why? Where did it all go wrong?
And yeah, I wonder how, if you had like Samir, how he looked in '83, or you had Labrada or McAway, if they competed in an open men's bodybuilding today, I mean, would they be awarded, or would they just be like, oh, you're way too small? You know, like Samir was 188 pounds. I mean, how would he beat a guy who's 240, you know?
If you're competing in an organization that fosters drug use, mm-hmm. and I don't even think that I have to name organizations, it's pretty simple. If you're competing in that organization, the physiques of Samir and the like are not going to be rewarded. It's just a matter of who's biggest, who's the biggest monster, who yeah. has the most muscle. But the shape, John, the shape is just grotesque. And mm-hmm. they stand there. They don't even know how to stand there. They have their legs spread apart. Right. They have arms up in the air. God, look at the guys that we had in the 70s and 80s. Yeah. They knew how to stand. They knew yeah. how to show their physiques without looking like an idiot on stage. I'm sorry. That's the way I feel.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a big proponent of classical look. That was, I think that's what drew me to it, is that great look, that defined yeah. look. And I'm sure, you know, I'm sure that it did the same for you. I'm sure yeah. that you had the same thoughts.
Well, I was at some of those late 70s shows in Columbus, too. I saw the three that Zane won, as like you did. And I remember Oscar State being on stage and yelling at the guys if they were flexing too much. You know, he's like, yeah. you got to relax. You know?
Yeah, I knew Oscar. I got to know Oscar. He got sick pretty much in the early 80s.
Did he?
Sick. Yeah. But he was a stickler for rules.
Mm-hmm.
Oscar was a stickler for rules. And,
yeah,
and,
he was.
And, but you know what? That's what made it, that's what made you walk the line. In fact, if the girls had the wrong suit, nope.
Yeah.
You got to change that suit. And he did it to Rachel Police, I remember.
Yeah, in the movie. Yeah, I remember that. That is not
the proper attire.
And then we could talk about the posing too, how the posing's changed so much.
Oh God. Listen, the guys that posed during the 70s, during the 70s and 80s, they knew how to pose, you know.
Mm-hmm.
These guys, they stand there like giant idiots, and they're so static. There's no transitions. There are so few guys that know how to pose today. One of the great posers of all time that I remember, besides Ed Corney, was Vince Taylor. He was a terrific poser, Vince.
Yeah,
And another great body, Vince Taylor. Another great body. You know, he had that look. Which we're fighting to bring back, John. We really are.
Right.
And we're going to do it. All that we have to do is stick to it.
I agree with you, John. It's just I think bodybuilding is a sport and an art. You know, like they said in that book, Pumping Iron, and it's a combination of muscle mass, of course, but it's the symmetry, the aesthetics, the posing, the presentation, which is a big part of it. And it's all that. And it's like living sculpture. You know, it's like moving sculpture. That's what it's supposed to be.
That's exactly what it is. And he who knows how to present that package the best usually comes out on top, especially if they have all the rest of the important factors there.
Yeah.
You have a presentation, boy. You're the winner.
Yeah.
You're the winner. And the audience knows, too. It's very easy for the audience to kind of recognize who the winners are.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when I first did my first pro show, I was a little nervous. I was called in at the last minute because I believe it was Roger Schwab who couldn't make it in for the show.
Okay.
And they were short one pro judge, and they called me in because I had a pretty good reputation as being a very good amateur level judge. And they called me in and they said, John, do you think that you're able to do this? I said, it's a piece of cake. I was shaking in my shoes. And I see these monsters walk out on stage and I say to myself, how the hell am I going to separate these guys?
Right.
How am I going to do this? And in 10 minutes, John, it falls into place by itself.
Mm, yeah.
all of the condition starts to show, the imbalances start to show, the presentations start to show, the pump starts to go down, you see the physique for what it is, and then you're saying, okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Then you start to make comparisons, and it becomes pretty easy after a while.
Yeah.
It becomes pretty easy. And that's what I did for 40 years. It was
fun. Amazing.
That's what I did for 40 years.
I'm going to ask you a tough question, John. Of all these guys you saw, all these contests, which ones are the ones that stick out? I mean, you mentioned Larry in 65 and that unbelievable ovation he got. But as you look back over your memories, can you make, you know, give me a couple that like really stand out that you always remember?
Well, Arnold does, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
Zane does. Haney.
Mm-hmm.
Probably Ronnie the first 2 years he won.
Yeah.
Okay. The first 2 years he won before the belly blew up. Mm-hmm. And I hate to say it.
How about Corny's posing in 77? You mentioned that.
Corny's posing was flawless.
Yeah.
I think that he had received almost as much as an ovation as Larry Scott did in 1965, not because of the size of his muscles, but the way that he presented himself. He was the first to capture the imagination of what the art of posing should be.
Mm-hmm.
And then guys did try to emulate that as time went on, but very few could do what he did.
Yeah.
And Ed was a little older at the time. He was like 44 or something like that.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? You know?
Yeah, 44, 45, and yet he kept his package together. But as far as standout bodybuilders, I think those guys kind of captured me more than anything else. I mean, they were so good, you know.
Yeah.
And I can't name one that was my favorite. I really can't name one. Because there were different eras, even though they were maybe 10 years apart, the era and the evaluation and the physiques did change, but they still had that symmetrical, balanced, aesthetic, well-conditioned look.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I loved about bodybuilding. And I still do.
Yeah, and me too. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, being a bodybuilding fan, I envy you that you saw that Larry Scott thing, and I really envy that you got to see Arnold at his best. That had to be amazing.
John, I feel so privileged, and I feel so lucky to have been there to witness all of those things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it was something that so many could never see.
Right,
something that, you know. And I remember I bought my $12 ticket for the first Mr. Olympia and sat third row center, man.
$12.
You know, that was it. But that's how I felt about it. And I still feel.
Yeah. Yeah, me too, John. I've been a bodybuilding fan since 77. And I saw some of those classic shows too. And I hate being older, but I'm glad I was around to get to see those shows when they happened, you know.
They were great. And, you know, I think that there was an appreciation for those bodies and those people back then. Because and people wanted to emulate those physiques. And and I think as the gym situation changed, and it's changed drastically, I understand that you have a very big gym where you are. I understand that you have a
powerhouse.
I hear that you have a wonderful facility. As the scene changed in gyms, hardcore bodybuilding became kind of a secondary, consideration for the kind of equipment that was brought in to the gyms until we had, and now we have the corporate gyms and Planet Fitness is not a gym to me, you know.
No, me neither. Yeah.
I mean, it's a place where people go to, you know, socialize and do some cycling or treadmilling or whatever. It's not a training facility to me.
Right.
But that's what it's become, maybe, because people have lost that interest in competitive bodybuilding for the most part. We have a few, And we have people like you that foster that, and I'm sure that you have some very good people in your gym,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I would love to see them in some of the IFBB PA shows. I would love to see those guys in our shows and, you know, some of the girls.
Yeah.
We reward them handsomely by sending them around the world. In fact, I tell most of our competitors who do well, why do you want to turn pro? You know, I mean, there's really nowhere for you to go. I mean, you have to pay your own way, your own fees, your own travel expenses mm-hmm. to everywhere that you go. If you win one of our shows, hey, we're going to send you to the Amateur World Championships or the shows in Dubai, in Barcelona, all over the world. Why
right.
would you want to be a pro? Hey, man, we're paying your way, you know? So, and I think that's why we're growing, because we're putting the athlete first. We're putting the
yeah.
competitive, you know, and right before every competition, I address all of the competitors and I tell them, and I mean this, John, without them, there is no competition, and we appreciate
yeah.
them being there. And I want this to be the best competitive experience of their life, whether they finish first or last. I want them to know that they're appreciated.
Yeah.
And I want to bring that feeling that we had in the 60s of this being a fun thing.
Right, right. Bring the camaraderie back in the atmosphere, yeah.
And that's how I feel. And that's what the old man thinks about that.
Well, I wish you the best of luck with that, John. And I thank you for coming on the show at such short notice and talking about the old days. It was great to hear your stories. And,
John, it has been my absolute pleasure. And I hope to meet you in Florida when we get down there on July 20th.
And, oh, yeah? Coming out here on July 20th? Okay.
Oh, we have a big international show in Miami on July 20th. It's actually a pro-am show.
Okay.
We have about 200 amateur contestants from the United States alone. And we're going to have about 100, maybe 150 pros coming in from Latin America and Europe. And it's going to be a show that's going to make a very big statement for the American bodybuilding and fitness scene. And I hope to see you there.
Yeah, I do too. I hope to meet you. Maybe you can come back to Tampa after you do your show in Miami.
Oh, that would be wonderful. That would be great. Oh, John,
all
I
right.
look forward to it. And thank you for having me.
All right, John. Thanks for being on the show. And it was great meeting you.
Good night. Be well.
All right, you too. Take care. Bye-bye. All right. Thank you for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends Podcast. Thanks to our sponsors, Florida Alternative Medicine and Old School Labs, for sponsoring this episode. And I also want to give a special shout out to all our Patreon donors who are helping to support the Bodybuilding Legends Podcast each week with their monthly donations. If you're interested in becoming a Patreon donor and you want to help support the website, you can go to our website, which is bodybuildinglegendshow.com. And you'll see right in the upper right-hand corner, there is a link for our Patreon link. And you can become a monthly donor. You can donate $5, $10, whatever you want per month to help support the show if you so choose. And I appreciate you thinking about it. All right. So without further ado, let's get to this article written by Mike Mentzer. It's called The Psychology of a Mr. Olympia Competitor. And as I said, this was probably Mike's highlight of his career, where he took second place at the 1979 Mr. Olympia. And this article was written right after that. So it says, the Olympia, the Big O, the Super Bowl of bodybuilding. No matter how the fans refer to it these days, the IFBB Mr. Olympia contest has grown in prestige over the years and inspires almost a sense of transcendent awe in some. Since its inception in 1965, and after 14 years of heroic and unforgettable battles twixt the gods, this one competition now reigns as the sport's knee plus ultra. I know I will never forget the thrill and excitement I felt as witness to many Mr. Olympia contests. When I was only a young teen, I saw Larry Scott summarily dispose of Harold Poole in the first Mr. Olympia, and then return the following year to soundly trounce an unbeatable Sergio Oliva and others before announcing his retirement. Of course, the fabulous Cuban returned in 67, looking out of this world and proved untouchable. The next year was essentially a repeat of 67, and that Sergio won the Olympia with nary a challenge. In 69, already established as the myth and feeling unbeatable, an imperturbable Sergio swaggered onto the Olympia stage, picking his teeth with an ivory toothpick to give that brash upstart, Arnold something or other, his deserved comeuppance. Ah, 1970. Sergio, now the king, his pin head swollen to the stars with confidence, showed up at the Brooklyn Academy of Music, his royal cloak lined with fat, to meet not Arnold what's-his-name, but a hungry Arnold Schwarzenegger, who had plugged into the source of a great collective Teutonic will to power since their last confrontation. Sergio was never quite the same after that defeat Arnold dealt him, while Arnold stayed hungry through 1975 to win an incredible 6 Mr. Olympias and, in large measure, give the title the prestige it enjoys today. With the Oak finally retired, 1976 saw the Sardinian Samson, a.k.a. Franco Colombo, barely eke out a victory over a very disappointed Frank Zane. Zane proved resilient, however, and rebounded admirably in 1977, the year of Zane, to defeat the favored, but as it turned out, improperly peaked Robbie Robinson. Robbie smarted from the sting of defeat and vowed to win in 78. And we all believe the Black Prince, as photos depicted a ripped, massive, and aesthetic Sergio-esque physique. But fate was again unkind to Robbie. Stricken with fever the night before the show, he bloated up, and Zane was Mr. Olympia again. Looking back over 1979, I'd say it was the most eventful year of my life by a long shot. It certainly started with a bang. In January, I entered into what promised to be an exciting professional relationship with one of Hollywood's top agents. Within weeks, my agent had procured a book deal for me with one of New York's largest publishers, as well as a poster deal and an appearance on the Merv Griffin Show. The momentum picked up even more when I defeated Robbie Robinson in my first pro contest. Beating Robbie at his best really boosted my confidence. For the first time, I knew deep down to my core that I could win the 1979 Mr. Olympia. My personal energy surge provided the fuel for some of the greatest workouts of my life. Making some of the best gains of my career, I would end each workout by relaxing in the shower, meditating on my successes, and thinking about the Olympia still months away. I would close my eyes and concentrate strongly until I'd lose awareness of the water beating down on my head and cascading over my pumped muscles. All that existed for me during those few brief moments of focused awareness was the image of me accepting the Mr. Olympia trophy. Every day I would practice this, always attempting to make the images more and more vivid. I knew that if I could make that which I desired so much come vibrantly alive in my mind's eye, my subconscious would be programmed toward a self-fulfilling prophecy. My body would then act according to this pre-programmed directive. The weeks and months rolled by in that early part of the year, and good things kept my spirits buoyed. My mail order business was booming, and I'd become engaged to my soulmate of 3 years, Kathy. With so much continued good progress, I was in full accord with Pangloss, as indeed, quote, all was for the best in this, the best of all possible worlds, unquote. Well, funny thing, I was soon to discover with considerable chagrin that it wasn't the will of fate to allow so much good fortune to continue through one person for so long. I lost a close one to Robbie in Pittsburgh, and a month later I dropped to an abysmal third behind Robbie and Danny Padilla in New York. Yes, I was discouraged and disappointed. No, I didn't like losing. Even less did I care to acknowledge the fact that Mike Mentzer's psyche was subject to the ebb and flow of external events. A week later, I was off to Germany for a seminar tour. In Germany, my good friend Albert Busack, the German national coach, tried to belittle the edge of defeat by force-feeding me my favorite ice cream for 2 weeks. Still stinging from my defeats, I returned to the U.S. by the end of May, only to be greeted by the devastating news that my dear mother had died. I wasn't totally unprepared for the news, as my mother had been sick for some time, but I still found the grief difficult to bear. With very little else to engage my energies for the summer, I became almost consumed by grief. Little else seemed to matter at that point. Having totally forgotten about competition, I continued eating with abandon, and I trained very little. I became plagued by an almost inexplicable free-floating anxiety that at times actually threatened to overwhelm me. So much for Mike Mentzer, the indomitable. I was physically deteriorating, and psychologically, I was fragile as an egg. I had all but lost touch with my core, the place where I resided so securely. My personal dilemma showed no signs of ceasing, and I went through the entire month of June and most of July like a somnambulist. If February had seen me at the zenith, then early July was certainly my nadir. Finally, one day towards the middle of July, my good friend George Schneider, the gym owner and promoter, called me to inquire whether I would enter the Best in the World contest a month later. Having forsaken the most basic principles of off-season dieting, I had slipped into the worst shape I'd been in for years. Realizing I could never get into shape in the allotted time, I told George I couldn't enter his contest because I was directing all of my energies into training for the Olympia in October. But it was George's call and other persistent reminders, such as the increasingly intense atmosphere at Gold's Gym, that shook me out of my depressive funk I was in and made me realize that the Olympia was indeed closing in, and fast. Great, I thought. A contest was just the thing in which to invest my energies, as past experience taught me that action was usually the best prescription for restless anxiety. Ordinarily, my confidence and energies burgeon at the prospect of an impending competition, but for some reason, the idea that I was about to prepare for my first Olympia evoked an altogether different response. Instead of bounding out of bed at 5 a.m., eagerly anticipating a workout, I find myself not wanting to get out of bed at all. It was a potentially dangerous sign. Upon awakening each morning, I would linger and wait for the ogre of self-doubt to creep in uninvited. Jesus, the Olympia. That was a title reserved for the immortals of the game, my heroes, Scott, Sergio, Arnold, Franco, Zane. What if I failed miserably? What if I didn't even place in the top six? My fans and all those who believed in me. Such was the chatter that my ogre would whisper to me each morning as I lingered in the protective womb of my bed. Only a few months before, I had read in The Psychology of Sport, Dorcas Susan Butt's informative book, that athletes are motivated by three distinct energies: aggression, neuroticism, and competence. All three energies contribute to an athlete's motivation, but one usually predominates. Suffice it to say that most of my energy was taken up in neurotic conflict at this time. Strangely enough, the undermining of confidence was not restricted to the area of physical performance, but spread to other areas of my life. For a time, life in general became very problematic. My brother Ray had moved to California earlier in the year and was proving that he meant business. Everyone in the gym was marveling at the improved, fantastic condition he was achieving. Seeing little brother Ray so huge and ripped for his contest, the Mr. America, a month away, wasn't exactly a boon to my confidence. Jesus, early August, 2 months to go to the biggest contest of my career, and I still look like crap. Ordinarily, 2 months was more than enough to get into contest shape, but I had never begun preparations before when I was so out of shape. While speculation grew rife at Gold's, Robbie has it this year, Padilla's going to be ripped for this one, never did I hear my name mentioned. I'd been written off. When I would spot check in front of a mirror, no one would even comment. They were being charitable, I suppose. Although daunted, I continued training furiously through August with my usual heavy, high-intensity workouts. In addition to three workouts, I had begun running up to 3 miles a day and posing an hour a day. August was all over before it had begun, or so it seemed, and with September upon us, I felt my back was against the wall. I had to reach the contest condition everyone, including myself, expected. Now, however, with barely 4 weeks to go, the imminence of the Olympia began to weigh on me like a 10-ton boulder. This caused the entire cast of my psyche to transform overnight. Like a person caught in a life-or-death situation, I found myself in possession of hidden energies. Writer-philosopher Colin Wilson refers to this phenomenon as the indifference threshold, or St. Neot's margin. He is referring to the fundamental recognition that crises or difficulties can stimulate a sense of meaning when more pleasant stimuli fail. Everything with which I came into contact at this time seemed to glimmer with a heightened sense of meaning. People, things, and even ideas emitted an energy upon which I fed. I knew exactly what poet William Blake meant when he said, "Life is a joyous dance of energy." People I came into contact with could sense that I was tuned into the source. One day I ran into Lisa Lyon at the post office, and she commented on the vitality I seemed to be radiating, saying she could sense it a block away. My favorite author, Henry Miller, who happens to employ Lisa as a cook once a month, might say that I was having an accord with the deeply centered rhythm of the cosmos. I finally reached a point where just about everything else in my life had to be relegated to a lesser place, temporarily at least. I think this is what Arnold meant in Pumping Iron when he said that emotional attachments were a negative influence before a contest. I don't think he meant that they were evil or something to be excluded forever. He only meant that when faced with an impending goal or test, all of one's energies must be focused on that. In fact, there was hardly a waking moment in that final month of preparation before the Olympia that I wasn't thinking about it. Whether it was grocery shopping or taking out the garbage, my purpose followed me like a shadow. While emotional relationships understandably cool at these times, they needn't suffer unduly if you have an understanding mate, as I do in Kathy. Gold's Gym ceased to be a mundane menagerie and became, for me, almost a mythical battlefield where I went to war with the weights and how I used to laugh at Joe Weider's bombing and blitzing as so much hype. It was during this last month of training that I realized one must evolve a siege mentality if he hopes to make optimal progress. I even became very enthusiastic about my posing for the first time, and I would go to see Joe 3 times a week for guidance. I dug out old stacks of Muscle Builder magazine, and I studied the best poses of the greats. In particular, I studied the back poses of Arnold at the 1975 Olympia, looking for clues on controlling the lower back. I practiced the relaxed poses of round one, the mandatory poses of round two, and my own individual free posing routine, not once, but several times a day. I was now a man possessed, living a life of high tension. I loved it. I was getting by on a few hours of sleep a night, and I was constantly active, yet I never seemed to show fatigue. American psychologist William James noted the same thing a long time ago in his own life, and he wrote about it in his essay, The Energies of Men. Quote, "If an unusual necessity forces us to press onward, a surprising thing occurs. The fatigue gets worse up to a certain critical point, and then it gradually or suddenly passes away, and we're fresher than before. We have evidently tapped a new level of energy, masked until then by the fatigue obstacle usually obeyed. There must be a layer after layer of this experience. A third and fourth wind may supervene." Unquote. What a turnabout. In early July, I didn't even want to get out of bed in the morning. Now I was so psyched, so addicted to the exhilaration of the struggle, I didn't want to go to bed at all. The philosopher Sartre has stated many times that he never felt so alive as when he was fighting for the French resistance against the Germans. Preparing for the Olympia was my moral equivalent of war. Activated by an intensely focused singularity of purpose, I felt myself to be all of one place. I was never at a crossroads. Coupled with this marvelous transformation of my psyche was an equally dramatic alteration in my physique. People couldn't believe the metamorphosis. Now when I spot checked in front of the mirror at Gold's, I was surrounded in an instant by a horde of onlookers. "Damn, Menser, you didn't look that way last week, or yesterday even." They were right. My physique was changing perceptibly from day to day. No more charitable silence from the peanut gallery. My growing intensity was contagious, and those around me were as psyched as I was. My size increased, my definition improved, and my confidence bounded. On many of my long runs along San Vicente Boulevard in Santa Monica, I'd feel the rush of vital energy streaming through my body, causing me at times to break out into a long belly laugh, which I had to stifle for fear of appearing maniacal to the other runners. This insanity, a controlled obsession, continued up through contest morning when I woke up and looked in the mirror to realize that everything I had done in my preparation, especially the last few days, had caused me to peak perfectly. I proceeded to the weigh-in adrenalized, bursting with confidence, anxious to strip down for the gaggle of photographers and officials presiding over the weigh-in proceedings. If only every human being could feel that way for 1 minute in his life, I was caught up in a 24-hour peak experience. Never once during the prejudging or the evening show did my confidence waver. Never before in a competition had I performed with such assurance. As the fire of competition came to a close with the evening pose down and the ashes finally settled, I was struck by the fact that while I had failed to win the title, I didn't feel defeated. Zane, of course, won his third Olympia, yet I felt victorious. It is now some 3 weeks later, and the sense of triumph remains. I did win in a sense. And all that's left to do now is return next year to Sydney and take my title. All right. Great article by Mike Menser from the March 1980 issue of Muscle and Fitness Magazine. All right, everybody. Thank you for joining me for another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends Podcast. We will be back next week with another interview. Thanks again to Florida Alternative Medicine and Old School Labs for sponsoring the show. We'll see you guys next week. Take care.